Morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here.
Hi.
We are live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. It is a Monday morning, and on Monday mornings, that's when Colin and Eric join me to take a look at the box office for the weekend and then review the movies. There aren't many movies to review. In fact, there is only one movie to review this week. And it won't take very long to do that. So we are going to talk about the box office. And let's talk about the lineup for the Chicago Critics Film Festival, which is May 1st through the 7th at the Music Box Theater. And we'll tell you all about that as well. So let's welcome Colin Suter. Colin, how are you?
Good.
Oh, welcome. And Eric Childress. Hi, Eric.
Hey, man.
All right. So we've only got one movie to review. We can do that in a couple of minutes. Let's talk about the box office. The headline of the box office report that you put together, Eric, says Furious 7 is just a short ride away from a billion.
Yeah, that pretty much sums it up.
What the hell?
$800 million.
It makes me. It just makes me giddy. Did it take seven movies for people to catch on to the greatness of this series?
Okay. We're going right back into last week. I think we all, whether they caught on or not. I mean, you had two things happen. One is that these films have gotten a little progressively better and a little more popular with each film, which is not something that happens at all.
No,
really.
It never happens. Like, no. Sequels, traditionally,
right?
Sequels do not improve.
No.
And the audiences don't get bigger.
No, it's a very rare thing. Look how long it took the James Bond series, for God's sakes, to have a $300 million film.
Yeah.
The last one, finally.
Yeah.
That series has been around for how many decades now? So it's crazy.
It's been around 50 years.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And the second thing, obviously, that happened was, Paul Walker's passing.
Right.
Which was just brought a whole new level. It really kind of gave this new film sort of a kind of a Dark Knight, feeling about it. The amount of press that was involved with it. People are just sort of appreciating the aspect that they managed to finish this film with all the problems that that passing could have caused, $800 million, and you put that in you really need to put that number in perspective, because a lot of blockbusters over the last few years have made $800 million. Okay, fine. The sixth film made $788 million.
Yeah.
Okay, so it is possible.
Yeah.
But this is only the third film in Universal's history to have grossed $800 million.
What were the other two?
Despicable Me 2, which grossed $970-some million, and Jurassic Park, $1.02 billion.
Oh, man.
That's the company that Furious 7 has right now. It's not unfeasible that it could pass Jurassic Park. Now, those are $1993
still.
Right. But, forget inflation, it could pass $1.02 billion.
That's unbelievable. That really is unbelievable. Man, oh, man. Now, did either of you guys watch the MTV Movie Awards?
No.
No.
No? Okay, I did.
There's only one reason I was going to watch them, and I'll probably watch the rerun if you tell me she was funny.
Amy Schumer?
Yes.
Well, she did fine. She did fine. She did, like bits, but like any host of an award show, she's on stage for a little bit and she's gone for a really long time.
Right.
Which is the case of, all of these shows.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, ridiculous. I mean, it was obviously ridiculous. Do you know what won Best Movie?
I saw that. Yeah.
What the hell's the name of the movie?
The
Fault in Our Stars. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Shailene Woodley, by the way, won like 800 awards. She was on stage. She was on stage half the night. She won like the Trailblazer Award. She won like Best Actress. She was on stage half the night.
Well, she had, I mean, she had that, and she had the Divergent movie. I mean, was Jennifer Lawrence not nominated or something?
No, Jennifer Lawrence was nominated.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, she won for the Fault of Our Stars.
Yeah.
Is what she won for. And, you know, I was like, I was completely, completely confused by the fact that Whiplash was nominated. Like, how did it was nominated for like a bunch of awards.
Yeah.
And I don't know how does Whiplash get nominated for the MTV Awards?
I mean, the entire thing is done by polls online, is it not?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. So, I don't know. Maybe some of Sony Classics, they're just hitting the button over and over and over again.
And Miles Teller, by the way, presented her with the Trailblazer Award, so you would have been very happy about that.
No. Hey, Miles Teller is fine with me right now because he did Whiplash.
All right,
so he's on a plus one right now, so that's fine.
Okay, so Furious 7 this weekend made $60.5 million, bringing its domestic total to $252 million, and as you said, $800 million worldwide.
Yeah, only eight films have hit $250 million in the U.S. faster than Furious 7.
And they are?
The Avengers, Dark Knight, Dark Knight Rises, The Hunger Games: Catching Fire, Iron Man 3, the last Harry Potter film, Transformers: Revenge of the Fallen. That's the second one for keeping count. and really, basically, by a matter of hours, the second Pirates of the Caribbean film.
Oh, okay, all right.
Yeah.
So Home comes in second with $19 million, bringing its total up to $129 million. Number three, The Longest Ride.
Our newbie this week.
The only movie that is reviewable, this $13.5 million. Did it open better than 8 seconds?
With
Luke Perry?
So.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. It might have even outgrossed 8 seconds. I'll be happy to look that info up for you.
Number four is Get Hard, $8.6 million. You know, they gave the Comedic Genius Award on the movie, on the MTV Movie Awards to Kevin Hart.
Really? For what? What was he in last year?
Well, I mean, well, he's in everything.
A Lifetime thing.
Yeah, it was like Comedic Genius Award. They gave it to him.
For what? Like Paul Blart Mall Cop, Grown Ups, and Zookeeper?
Kevin Hart.
Kevin Hart.
Kevin Hart. You're thinking of the other. You're thinking of.
Yeah.
Well, wait a minute. You're thinking of Kevin James.
Yeah.
Kevin Hart, who's been in every movie, who's been in like 1,700 movies.
In 2 years.
Yeah. So they gave him the Comedic Genius Award.
Okay.
Yeah. You're getting a little confused, man.
Yeah, I am. It's late.
Number five is Cinderella, $7.2 million. And then, of course, we have to say the full title, the Divergent series, Insurgent. $6.8 million. Now it's $114 million right now.
Mm-hmm.
Those numbers are down, right?
Yeah, yeah. The previous film made $150 million in the U.S. and I think it's going to be slightly down or about on par what it made worldwide. The first one, which is not the numbers Lionsgate was hoping for.
All right, seven, Woman in Gold with $5.8 million. And eight, this is the deal right here. It Follows with $2 million, bringing its total up to 11.7. But this is it's very successful.
Yeah, that's a big hit for that movie.
Big hit and really good.
Yeah.
Really good and really creepy. Number nine, Danny Collins, $1.6 million. And is it in – how many theaters is Danny Collins in? Is it a small amount of theaters, right?
Very small amount. I think I know they increased it this week, obviously. That's what made it in there. But 739 theaters.
I liked it, man. Did you guys see it?
I still haven't seen it.
Eric?
Me neither.
God, I liked it. I thought it was good. And then number 10, While We're Young, with $1.3 million, bringing its total up to $2.3 million. Which I also liked.
And that's only in 246 theaters.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. All right.
Here are your 8 seconds numbers, by the way, Nick.
Oh, you actually pulled up 8 seconds numbers?
Of course I did. Of course I did.
All right.
Your opening weekend, this was only on 836 theaters, mind you.
Okay.
It opened to $3.3 million.
Mm-hmm.
Its domestic total gross was $19.6 million.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So Longest Ride needs to gross $6 million more.
Yeah. By Friday, it'll have outgrossed 8 seconds. Released in 1994.
That's right. 8 seconds. Ridiculous. All right, you guys, hang on. Okay, hang on. There's Colin. There's Eric. We got to take a quick break. We'll talk a little bit more about the box office. We've got one movie to review, but more importantly, we do have the Chicago Critics Film Festival, which is running May 1 through the 7th at the Music Box Theater on Southport, and we'll give you the rundown on that schedule as well right here on 720 WGN. Morning, everybody. It's Nick DiGilio here on a Monday morning. And, yeah. So we are talking about the new movies. And coming up in just a little bit, John McNaughton and Steve Jones will join us to talk about their movie The Harvest, which is now available on demand. Colin and Eric are with us. We've got one movie to review. Unless we want to talk about The Harvest, we could review that because that's available on demand. But we're doing some talk about the top 10 movies of the week in terms of box office. Welcome back, guys.
Thank you.
All righty then. What are the big stories about this week for box office, Eric?
Well, I think it's basically just Fury 7. I mean, we already mentioned just the extraordinary numbers that thing is putting up. I mean, even, you know, to do $60 million in its second weekend is a pretty extraordinary feat. I mean, once you start with $147 million, what it ended up last weekend, you're going to have a huge drop no matter what. I don't care how good the movie is.
Right.
And to keep it at $60 million that's a pretty solid drop. And of course it had no competition. No studio wanted to even try, pretty much to go after this movie in a second weekend. That's why you only got really one wide release this week
right. That
we'll be talking about.
Right.
And even the Nicholas Sparks movie. I mean the popularity of these things have seemed to have been waning a little bit. The last film that came out last October that I don't even know how many people remember, called The Best of Me, with James Marsden and Michelle Monaghan, was the weakest grossing film of all of these films, going back to Message in a Bottle in 1999. So the Sparks brand has been around for now 15-plus years.
How many books has this guy written?
Too many. Too many. Yeah. And there's a great meme that's around, if you can find it. Like, there's like a book, anytime a movie comes out, bookstores put, all of his books on display, basically.
Yeah.
And the meme just basically says, white people almost kissing. which is the poster of every single Nicholas Sparks movie.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Oh man. All right. So that made $13.5 million, and we'll talk a little bit about that one, review that one in a couple of seconds. All right. So Furious 7 is the huge winner with $60.5 million at the box office. All right. Let's talk about the movie for this week. Colin.
Yeah.
Yeah, why don't you tell us about The Longest Ride.
Yeah. All right. Well, this is the latest bull riding drama from Nicholas Sparks.
From the series of bull riding dramas that he has done.
Oh, there's just so much drama to be had out. Anyway, Scott Eastwood plays a bull rider, a champion who...
And that, by the way, is Clint's son.
Yes. And he's a champion who gets brutally injured early in the film after having a rough night with a bull called Rango. I didn't make that up. And then Britt Robertson plays a college co-ed who goes with her friends to see some bull riding, and that's when she meets Scott Eastwood. And so despite their educational differences, they start dating. She's an art history major, and apparently the only one to ever land a New York internship. Because apparently in New York, they have a hard time finding someone in the area interested in art who doesn't mind working for nothing. Guess that's New York for you. Just like Boston, it's not really a big college town, you know?
They all recruit in North Carolina, Colin. This is a known fact.
Exactly. So, and then he, of course, has no interest in art or interest in leaving home. He just wants to ride bulls. So one night they're out driving, and they drive by a car that has just smashed into a tree. And inside is Alan Alda. And
Alan Alda? No, I'm sorry. That's just it's a commercial we play for Craig Ferguson's show. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Anytime I hear Alan Alda's name, Dan and I just, it's always, Alan Alda? So, okay, go ahead.
All right, so they rescue Alan Alda, and his big block, his big box of letters. And because this is a Nicholas Sparks joint, we're going to find out what's in those letters.
Joint?
And it turns out I got all the Nicholas Sparks joints, yeah. And turns out these letters, they're like a gateway to flashbacks. And suddenly the movie has two stories that it wants to tell. So for the rest of the movie, Alan Alda, is in the hospital. And Britt Robertson keeps coming to visit him and read him the letters that he wrote to his wife, who never actually leaves him in the film. So he wrote all these letters to his wife. But it's not really clear why, because she was there living everything with him that he's writing about. And they were mailed to her. So it's very unclear what's going on there. But, you know, their story is going to become important in the lives of these two youngsters in the end. So basically, it's a story about compromise and how necessary it is to sustain a relationship. Except the movie completely sidesteps that with an ending where neither of them have to compromise at all. Everything just sort of works out. Sorry, I didn't mean to spoil the ending of the Nicholas Sparks film. But the movie is nothing but cliches, and it's all over the map with them. And what's worse is the movie has no idea that it has an interesting story right in the middle of it. It's a very small story that takes place. It involves all Alan Alda's wife in the flashback being a school teacher and caring for one of her students whose parents are, you know, violent. And I thought, oh, let's stop and tell this story. This is a good story right here. Let's do this one. You know, if they told that story and left out all this other nonsense, they might have had some. Not only that, but if you do the math with this film, Alan Alda's character is supposed to be 65 years old because he was in World War II. The most sprightly, most alert 95-year-old man to ever drive a car at night. You know, very strange. So, this is you know, your typical Nicholas Sparks, you know, ridiculousness that, you know, I can't even imagine it reading well on the page. But and you know, when it comes to bullfighting, or bull riding, I should say, I'm always rooting for the bull. At least I got to cheer a couple times whenever Scott Eastwood gets, you know, slammed into a wall. And it also made me think about, like, what guy is that a typical thing? Do guys really want to have sex after bull riding? I don't know about that. Watching this guy get his nuts slammed for, you know, 5 minutes and then, you know, do a love scene right after that. I feel like you're stretching things a little bit. Maybe that's just me. Not a good film.
Okay. Eric, go ahead, man.
Yeah. I get the This is a film that is sort of just devoid of any sort of dramatic context whatsoever. I mean, it starts off with the basically, you know, you got the pretty white people at the beginning of the movie having their meet cute, and we're sort of thrust into their sort of, you know, wrong side of the tracks romance and whatnot. And, you know, the best thing you can say about it is that it's just completely bland and inoffensive in a way. It's cliche ridden, but at least just kind of bland and inoffensive. Then it, you know, sneaks in this whole, you know, backstory with Alan Alda and whatnot, the most disappointing aspect of which is that the young Alan Alda, when we go back to flashback, is not played by Bill Hader. very disappointed that it was played by Jack Huston, who looked nothing like Alan Alda. But, you know, and then, you know, and then even you know, the whole movie, there's just so little going on. There's so little to care about. Nothing original is happening. Like Collins, you know, suggests you're trying to figure out, you know, why he's writing these letters to her when, you know, they're together for the entire film. And all it made me kept thinking of the old George Carlin joke about 1 hour photos. Basically, you just saw the thing. And Colin's right. I mean, this whole movie sort of, you know, gets to a point, and this movie's over 2 hours long, by the way.
Yeah.
And it gets to a point where you finally, like, get the message of the movie or the theme or the anthem or whatever they want this movie to be or to have. And it's basically that love requires sacrifice, that's the whole point. I'm like, oh, okay, well, that's a nice cliched message for everyone to learn. And then 15 minutes later, as Colin said, everything works out for everybody.
Right.
You know, and I guess the best thing you can say about this Nicholas Sparks film is that it doesn't have, you know, it sneaks in some sort of malady for the Scott Eastwood character at one point, but it's not really paying it off the way other Sparks movies do.
Right.
It doesn't sort of have the evil father who's going to tell her not to be with him, or, you know, the evil
right.
ex-boyfriend
right.
that, you know, is going to cause, you know, someone to, you know, have a treehouse fall on them in a river. you know, that's about the best thing you can say about this movie, other than the two leads are extraordinarily pretty together. But no, this is just another bad film.
Yeah, I just, you know, I'm disappointed that George Tillman directed this movie, because I like him, and, you know, and he's done some good stuff in the past, and done good romantic stuff in the past. But yeah, this is just, I mean, come on. But like, you know, like letters that have to be found and written and sent, isn't that like a Sparks thing?
Well,
isn't that like a thing? Like in all of his work?
Yeah. And it's had spinoffs too. I mean, Letters to Juliet, that's pretty much what that movie was about in a way. You know, that wasn't a Sparks movie, but, you know, clearly other people are taking a clue from this guy's formula.
Bad stuff. And I, you know what? And I'm, you know, I will say this, it's bad. He's 90% of the, 99% of the Nicholas Sparks movies are bad, because I still like The Notebook. I don't care.
No. That's not good either, but it's better than that.
But I'm the only person in the world I actually like The Notebook. Okay, you guys, hang on. We got more stuff to talk about. And most importantly, we're going to be talking about the Chicago Critics Film Festival. Morning, everybody. Yeah, Nick DiGilio here. We are live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. It is a Monday morning, which means we review the movies. And we reviewed the Longest Ride, which was the only movie to review. We went over the box office. But what we really want to jump into with Colin and Eric. Colin, Eric, thank you, guys. Welcome back.
Thank you.
So let's talk about the Chicago Critics Film Festival, which is May 1st through the 7th at the Music Box Theater this year. It started, you guys, the inaugural one was last year, correct?
No, it was 2 years ago.
Oh, 2 years
actually.
Ago.
Okay. Yes, 2 years ago. Last year was our first year at the Music Box.
Okay.
And we're returning there again this year for our third year already.
Wow. That's amazing. That's really great. So who is responsible for how many people are involved and who is responsible for picking the films that are shown?
Really, there's kind of a handful of us, actually. They're sort of the main team. I sort of put this thing together the first year and really sort of handpicked a team that includes Colin as well as Brian Tallarico and Peter Sobczynski and Steve Procopi. And we're sort of the five guys that are sort of now scouring the film festival world looking for the best things available that we can bring to Chicago for premiere. And we've sort of crafted this sort of what is essentially kind of like a greatest hits festival of all the festivals out there.
Well, it's great. And I'm looking at the schedule. Now, you guys have had some you've had like Sarah Polley showed up.
She was our inaugural guest.
Yeah, the first one.
Year.
Yeah.
The very first celebrity to actually sign on. We had such a great the first year it was amazing, you know, for just an idea that we were putting together in essentially basically 3 months, that we had such a wonderful response, people that were interested in being a part of this. And Sarah Polley had Stories We Tell coming out, and we were able to get her for opening night. And that was the year we also had William Friedkin was coming through Chicago on his book tour,
right.
And he brought Sorcerer, 35mm print of Sorcerer with him,
Lord.
And we closed out with that.
That's fantastic. So, all right, tell me a little bit about what you guys did last year. Tell me about the highlights from last year.
Well, last year our opening night film was the great They Came Together. David Wayne was here for opening night.
Yeah, that movie's awesome.
It's so funny, and the response at the theater. It was funny that we were told from people at Lionsgate who really gave the film kind of a small release afterwards, where they were actually considering upping the quantity of the release based on the response that we had here at the Music Box.
Is that right?
Screening. Yeah, the response to the film, it played at Sundance last year, and it got a decent response at Sundance. Obviously, got picked up there, but I guess the screenings in L.A. and New York didn't go over as well, and they were actually calling Lionsgate during the screening, saying you have to hear what's going on at this theater because they're going crazy for it. So Chicago clearly got the movie.
Clearly.
Yeah. so for a brief moment in time, they're actually considering, you know, doing something more with it. And I think it might have just been too close to the release to actually, you know, work out the logistics. But
yeah,
that was our opening night, and we packed the place.
Yeah. Well, it's a terrific movie. Terrific yeah. movie. So tell us about this. Now, Colin, you work on the short films. You program the short films, correct?
Yeah, so this is, for the past 2 years, we've had two sets of short film blocks that I put together. And just like, it's, you know, sort of a micro version of our festival. It's the same basic idea. It's like a greatest hit package of all the best short films that have played, not all of them, obviously, but that have played the festivals, you know, in the year prior.
Yeah.
So this year, though, I get to have a third slot, a midnight slot, which I'm so excited to do. I've been wanting to do this ever since we started, was just have a block of short films that are geared towards horror and genre stuff and just, you know, cult movie stuff. And so we're doing that this year on our opening night, actually, our Friday night at the Music Box opening night. We're doing a block of short films that is headlined by your buddy Ryan Oliver's latest film, Restoration, which is a fantastic little treat that sort of inspired or influenced, as far as I can see, by Carpenter and Walter Hill and, you know, the little demon child thrown in. And if you want to have a good laugh, look up Restoration, the short film on IMDb, and just look at the character list. It reads like a George Miller film. It's really funny. It's just the character names are just a riot. So we got like four movies playing before that. That's like a 45-minute film. He makes these, you know, mid-length features. They're not really shorts. They're mid-length features. They're like 35, 45 minutes.
Yeah.
You played his movie Air Conditions a couple of years ago at the Mico.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this is going to go over really well.
Ryan's an amazing dude. Ryan is a friend of mine for many years, and you know, I was in Among the Dead, and he wrote and directed that, and this great play about zombies. And he's gone on to do some really great stuff. And he clearly, you know, is inspired by these kind of guys that you're talking about. There's no question about it.
Yeah, and you can tell. I mean, he stepped it up a notch even more with this movie.
Cool.
I can't wait to watch this stuff with a crowd. So it's got four short films playing before that. You know, a couple of them are animated. One of them is an experimental film. One of them is a very sick movie about revenge. And, you know, these movies have won awards, too. They're not just weird, you know, weird sakes. These are really well-crafted, beautifully made movies that are going to just play so well with the
audience. Very cool. All right, you guys, hang on. We're going to do take one more break, and then we'll come back and talk more about what's happening at the Chicago Critics Film Festival, which starts on May 1st and goes through May 7th, and it's at the Music Box Theater. We'll give you all more information coming up right here on 720 WGN. Nick DiCiglio here. We are live in the Allstate Studios on the 7th floor of the Tribune Tower. It is Monday morning. Later on, we'll be hearing from my dad, who's going to tell us a jokey time, because that happens every Monday morning. And also, after 3 o'clock, a little bit later on, we're going to be talking with John McNaughton and Steve Jones. John McNaughton is the director of this new movie, The Harvest, which is now available on video on demand. Steve Jones is his producer, and we will talk about that coming up. But right now, we're discussing the Chicago Critics Film Festival, which starts May 1st, goes through May 7th at the Music Box Theater. Colin and Eric have helped program it, and they are part of the Chicago Film Critics as well. Welcome back, guys.
Thank you.
Hello.
Eric, tell me about some of the movies that you guys are going to be showing. Digging for Fire is your first film. You talked about this one before.
Yeah, this is our opening night film, and with Ryan Oliver at midnight, we got sort of a bookend of Chicago filmmakers. Digging for Fire is Joe Swanberg's latest film with an incredible cast. Jake Johnson, Rosemary DeRitz, Sam Rockwell, Brie Larson, Anna Kendrick, amongst others. And that's going to be our opening night film. And it's going to be followed, which is about sort of a perfect bridge between that and the shorts, the film Raiders.
Now, I saw the trailer for this.
Yeah.
It looks fantastic.
Yeah.
It's these kids who made these guys, not kids, well, they were kids when they started.
They were kids, yeah.
Yeah, when they made like a frame-for-frame remake of Raiders, Raiders from the Lost Ark.
Yeah, well before Gus Van Sant had the idea with Psycho. These kids, over the course of 7 years, were just from 1982 to 89, were so in love with Steven Spielberg's Raiders of the Lost Ark that they decided to make their own version. And, you know, they did it, you know, pretty much shot for shot with their own special effects and whatnot. And this documentary is not just detailing, you know, how, you know, they went about making that. They made the entire film, and it became this underground cult thing, eventually.
Right.
But they had one scene that they weren't able to finish, and that's the plane sequence, which is like my favorite sequence in the film. And so they get, you know, after all these years of sort
of... The plane sequence, which one do you mean? Do you mean... when he's in the fist fight on the wing of the plane?
Yes, with Karen Allen's in the cockpit.
Oh, all right, okay, cool.
Yeah,
because there's another plane scene. Well, I mean, just like when he's at the beginning in the movie.
Yeah, no, they did that one.
Yeah, okay.
the big action sequence.
Gotcha.
And the movie is sort of, it's about all after we sort of catch up with these guys decades later as they've sort of all gone their separate ways and trying to find the way to basically sort of get together and film this last scene to complete this thing. And it's a movie that takes on a lot of surprises. I mean, it seems like it starts off as going to be sort of this, you know, down home kind of, you know, goofy, you know, little trip down memory lane of how they made this movie.
Right.
And the film actually gets, you know, a little bit darker and whatnot. And we see what happened to these guys. And the last 15 minutes of this film are just fantastic.
Awesome.
Just like extraordinarily fantastic. And you want to stay through the end credits, obviously. But that, I mean, opening night is going to kill.
Boy, that's big, man. That's great. Okay, tell me about some of the other ones that you guys are going to be doing. Now, I know that your closing night on Thursday night, this movie that you've talked about that I can't, you know, you read anything about this movie online or anything about it, and people are losing their minds over this movie, Me and Earl and the Dying Girl.
Yeah, that's
your closing night film.
on May 7th. Yeah. We're having two films on closing night. The Overnight is going to be at 6 o'clock, which is another Sundance film with Jason Schwartzman and Adam Scott. That's really terrifically funny.
Right.
And then we're at 8:30, Me and Earl and the Dying Girl. And both directors will be there for Q&As for closing night. We have some really wonderful guests. We have a lot of filmmakers.
Who else is coming in? Tell me about some of the other people that are coming in.
We got on Tuesday night, May 5th, we're going to have a documentary called Drunk Stone Brilliant Dead, which is the story of National Lampoon magazine.
Oh, come on.
Yeah. And it's a really fun, story, obviously. And the director, Douglas Tirola, is going to be there. It's kind of a perfect film to play here in Chicago, obviously.
Absolutely.
And there's a lot of footage that you haven't seen before with, Belushi and Chevy Chase and these guys rehearsing and stuff. It's really a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So that's Tuesday night. Wednesday, next on the May 6th, James Ponsoldt, speaking of Shailene Woodley and Miles Teller, is going to be with his latest film, The End of the Tour, with Jason Segel and Jesse Eisenberg about David Foster Wallace.
Okay.
That's going to be Wednesday. Saturday night, we have another Swanberg film. We have Joe's wife, Chris Swanberg, and her film Unexpected is going to be the 7 o'clock film on Saturday. And before that, we're also going to be playing Andrew Bihalsky's Results with Guy Pearce, Kobe Smulders, and Kevin Corrigan. And Kobe Smulders will be there for both screenings.
Wow. That's great, man.
Yeah. So we're really excited about that. And if Saturday night could not get any better, after Chris's film, at 9:30 p.m., Bobcat Goldthwait and Barry Crimmins will be here for Call Me Lucky, his documentary from Sundance this year.
Wow.
Which, we've praised Goldthwait to the hilt here on this show.
Yeah.
Certainly. And I still contend this might actually be his best work to date.
Yeah. I remember you reviewing it. No, that's great. It's great. So Goldthwait's going to be there.
Yeah, Goldthwait and Barry Crimmins, who is the
subject of the film, the comedian.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man. Okay. Well, it's a great lineup. If people want to get tickets or, want to check out all the information in the complete schedule, what's the website?
Well, you can go to ChicagoCriticsFilmFestival.com, and the entire lineup is there right on the front page. You can see we got their passes on sale. You can buy a pass for the entire festival. It's $150, which is quite a deal. Or you can buy individual tickets, which are also on sale at the Music Box Theater website. If you go to the special events section, just scroll down. You'll find the Chicago Critics Film Festival, and there are tickets available for every film. Seriously, we could not be prouder of this lineup, and Colin has watched like 8,000 shorts put his programs together, and they're always so much fun. And the response so far to the lineup has really kind of been very humbling. So we're really looking forward to sharing these movies with Chicago.
Very cool. Well, you know what? We got a couple of weeks before it happens, so we'll talk about it again next week.
Cool.
Chicago Film Critics Festival, ChicagoFilmCriticsFilmFestival.com starts May 1st, goes through the 7th at the Music Box Theater. The schedule looks great. There's going to be a lot of great things, a bunch of feature films. Colin put together a great program of short films as well, and all that will be happening starting on May 1st, and we'll talk more about that. So movie-wise, what do we got next week?
Next week we got Ex Machina.
Science
fiction film that I've talked about before. And what else we got? Paul Blart, Mall Cop 2.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Enjoy. My old producer, Andy Herman, is, I believe he's already in line.
Yeah, well, I don't think they're screening that one for anyone this week, so.
Well, he doesn't care. He's probably in a sleeping bag right now in front of a movie theater waiting for
Paul Blart. Phantom Menace, huh?
Yeah, he absolutely loved, I can't tell you how excited he was about Paul Blart when it first came out. And every time, and this is the funny thing, and Dan, you know this, every time I would just say the name Paul Blart, he would laugh because it sounds like fart. And
seriously, is that the reason?
Oh, well, yeah, exactly. He's a fat guy and it sounds like Blart, or it sounds like fart. So his name is Paul Blart. And this is the guy, by the way, who came up with Straight Out of Context.
Okay.
Yeah, so that explains everything. Don't you think that explains everything?
Yep.
His favorite his favorite television show of all time is Three's Company.
I was just going to say that.
Absolutely. There you go.
Yeah.
All right. So Paul Blart 2. Maybe I'll have Andy. Maybe we can have Andy guest review it next week, Dan. Let's try and get a hold of Andy. What do you think?
Anything that saves us from having to see it. Sure.
There you go. All right. Colin, Eric, thank you, guys.
Thank you.
And we will talk again next week and talk more about the Chicago Critics Film Festival.